Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Kim and I are glad to be back at our Northwest congregation. Unfortunately, today will be a shorter visit for us. Earlier in the year, we had committed to be at a celebration of baptism for my cousin, my daughter of my nephew in Cincinnati. So we won't be able to stay for some of the lunch and such, and we have to slip out at one point. But it's very good to be here and share God's word with you. Today we're going to talk about Psalm 139. I came across, as I was preparing about this, some information. In May of 2023, then Surgeon General Vivek Murthy made a national statement that loneliness was a national epidemic in the United States. And he said that for very good reasons. If you look at a study that was published in the Journal of the American Psychiatric Association the next year in 2024, found that about 30% of Americans, people living in America, will say that they feel lonely at least weekly. And 10% of the population says that's a daily problem. What's surprising about the study, though, was particularly that the highest group was in the 18 to 34-year-old range. What's surprising about that, that is a group that is predominantly around people. It's not that they're lonely because they're isolated. They're around people. And of all our generations, that's certainly the most connected on social media. In fact, one of the things that people complain about is they're constantly on their phone. They're constantly interacting with people. However, they are the loneliest generation. And so that study brings up a lot of questions and thoughts, but one of them is that one can feel alone or isolated when you're around people. And so there's something there that it's not just being around people. There's some other things that have to happen there. We won't go into that. That could be a long discussion, but we're going to turn our attention more to what do you think about God? When you think about God, is God distant? Are you feeling lonely from God? Is God present in your life? As we look at Psalm 139, the psalmist David is going to state to us that reality is that God is present. Not only is he present, he is intimately involved in every aspect of your life. Psalm 139, you have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all of my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. That word search there has the context of being a deep search, a complete search. And we can see that by just what is said in those next verses there. God knows where I am and what I'm doing, when I'm sitting, when I'm rising. He knows what I'm thinking from afar. You know, it's interesting. My wife and I have been married many years. I think this is 43 years. We celebrated in August. And, you know, my wife can complete my sentences for me. I can complete her sentences and all. But God not only can complete our sentences, he can start them. Before it's even in our minds, before it's completely formed in our minds, going to our mouth, God knows it. That's how intimately he is involved with us. The New Testament confirms this, says in 1 Corinthians 13:12, for now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, then we will see face to face. Now I know in part, knowing in part who God is, knowing God, then I shall know fully, and I emphasize this last part, even as I am fully known. What I would suggest that Corinthians, this verse in Corinthians would suggest to us that we can sometimes be clouded in the sense of we thinking that God doesn't know us or is distant from us because we live in a fallen world. We live in a sinful world. We have our own problems. And so we see God as in a distant reflection, as a mirror. We don't see his full glory, but we shouldn't confuse that with the fact that God knows us fully. He knows every aspect of who we are and what we're doing. Going back to Psalm 139, you hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Now, growing up in the United States and I would say that for some people, this idea of God hemming me in behind and before me, in other words, as I go forward, he's there, he's got me controlled and contained, that could seem like an unpleasant thing. In the United States, we like to think of self-determination. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I did it my way, you know, famous song there. It's and we glorify self-accomplishment and such, you know, every it's all about me. And there's obviously some positive things. They're not everything is bad about some of those concepts, but they can get to be very toxic and very much of a problem. And what the psalmist tells us here is, no, what he celebrates, he says, this knowledge is too wonderful, is that God is constantly there guiding and protecting me. No, I'm not self-determining. I'm not self-fulfilling. It is God who is there constantly guiding me. This brings us to kind of think about maybe Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right path for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So this picture David gives us in Psalm 23 is God is our shepherd and his guiding is good. He guides us where there's green pastures. You know, if you're a sheep, that's a good thing. He makes us lie down by the quiet waters. He refreshes our soul. But even then he turns to us and says, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. And why will he fear no evil? Because God is with him and his rod and his staff comforts me. Probably most of you have thought about this before or heard talks about this. But, you know, a shepherd has two main tools, his rod and his staff. And those two things are primarily to do two things. One is protect the sheep from any wild animals that may come, and to guide them where they need to go. He has the rod to fight, and the staff is curved, and so he can guide the sheep wherever they need to go. And so sheep need guiding. They tend to wander off. I've heard this from people who actually took care of sheep, that nope, sheep tend to wander off. You need to guide them to where they need to go. They need to be taken care of. And so going back to Psalm 139, David celebrates this. He says, no, God is there protecting me, and he has me constantly taken care of. Psalm 139 goes on, verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. You know, if we look at Psalm 23, there's also that part of, even if I walk through the darkest valley, and here again it says, you know, surely the darkness will hide me. That word darkness really has two contexts. It has the literal meaning of what you would think of dark, that there's not much light. You can't see well. The road is difficult because it's very dark. But it also has a more metaphorical or meaning of that darkness, such as what is evil, what is difficult, what even to death. You know, back to Psalm 23, the King James Version and other versions still keep that, even if you take me through the valley of death, because that word darkness has that context of it can be, again, just lack of light, but it also can be that danger and evil. And I think that's one of the times that becomes very difficult for us to feel God's presence, is when we're going through very dark times, when we're maybe afraid, when there's times are evil, or maybe we're facing either family death or maybe our own mortality. But the psalmist assures us that even if we think the darkness will hide God from us, that we're hidden from God, says that's not true. There's no such thing as dark to God. God can, even darkness is like light to him. He can see us. He's there with us. And if we go to the top of this section of Psalm 139, it just assures us again that God is everywhere. He's present wherever we go. It doesn't matter where we're at. I like verse 9. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. If I went to the furthest areas that I could go to, God is still going to be present with me. He will be there. But God's intimacy, going to Hebrews chapter 13, 5, also again the New Testament, I like to see this, how the New Testament and the Old Testament, they're the same message. Hebrews 13, 5 to 6. Keep your lives free from the love of money. Be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we can say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? And so the first part I chose this is simply that statement again, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. God is always there present with us. But it brings up another thing that can cloud our view of God. And here we see that the writer of Hebrews connects this need to remember that God is with us with the love of money. And living in the United States, again, we have this opportunity to have much more material things and to chase after material things. We don't want that to cloud our view. If we just seek the material, God says he knows we need food and clothing and shelter. But if we just seek that, it will cloud our view that God is constantly present with us. And so in Hebrews, it reminds us that never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. And it's because God is present and he's our helper that we don't have to be afraid. Psalm 139, starting again with verse 13. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. So God's intimate knowledge of us started before we were born. It started when we were created in our mother's womb, and God was there with us. He says, our frame was not hidden from you. But so God is there from the very beginning, even before we were born. But God is there in our future. And in verse 16, we don't want to miss this, that all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. God already knows our future, and he's already stated he'll be there in the present. We don't have to worry that, okay, God was with me today. Or last year, I remember I had this big problem, and God helped me through that. I turned to God, and I felt his presence. We don't have to worry, but what about tomorrow? Because God already knows your tomorrow. And God has already promised to be there for tomorrow. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. As I was doing some review and study for this, for Psalm 139, I always thought, okay, yeah, God's thoughts, he created everything, he knows everything, yeah, his thoughts are vast. That didn't surprise me, but as I was studying it and reading scholars going through Psalm 139, they said, yes, that's true, but the context of Psalm 139 is thoughts about David in particular, or thoughts about us in particular. That what is surprising to the psalmist, what is surprising to David as he writes this, is it's the vast sum of God's thoughts about him particularly, which means also God's thoughts about you. I don't know if you think about that very often, but God is constantly thinking about you. It says in the Bible that even the hairs on your head are numbered. Not just how God knows how many there are, he knows the numbers of them. Now that's trivia God knows about you. But God just, he thinks about you constantly. How vast the sum of the thoughts that he has about us. And again, he says, when I awake, I am still with you. Now, as we get to this next part of the psalm, it takes a dramatic change. And I remember being a younger believer, and the first times I read Psalm 139, I remember wanting to take white out and kind of color over some the verses 19 through 22, or maybe take a scissors, or just ignore this part, because you have this beautiful psalm, and then suddenly it takes this huge change. It says, if only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Psalm 139 is a very complex psalm. It combines many different types of psalms all put together in one. A praise psalm, it recounts what God does. And it has what is called, in technical words, an imprecatory psalm, or an imprecatory part to the psalm. And what that means is that in these type of psalms, imprecatory psalms, the writer calls for God to act justly, to address wickedness, to see what is happening in the world and end wickedness, to act in that way. And so at first this seems almost a shock as we read this psalm, but I think it makes quite a bit of sense to us as David is going through and seeing the glory of God and this wondrous and how much he cares about him, but not only him, but everybody. And then he thinks about the way the world is, and he reacts in anger and asks God, I want you to do something about this. Remember those who seek blood who are bloodthirsty. You know, Kim and I were just in Kyrgyzstan. We had the opportunity to go with the group from our church to do a vision trip to see what's happening there. And it was a wonderful trip. Much more, you'll hear more about that, I think, in November. But one of the things that we did is we went to different schools with the Mercy Children's, Christian Children's Fund, or GLEC, as some of you might know of it. And it was wonderful to see. We saw dedicated teachers, and they have at each school spiritual coordinators who go and really are working in the lives of the children, but not only the children, the parents. And it's a wonderful thing to see. And another place we went to, there's a school, but there's also right by the school is an orphanage. And as we were at the orphanage, we were talking about, you know, what was going to happen to the orphans and all. It was important, you know, that they be in the school and the protection they had in the school, because kids in Kyrgyzstan who are orphans and poor can be trafficked. They can be trafficked for forced slave labor or for sex trafficking. And as you've seen the care of the kids and these people loving on them, and you see little kids' faces, and I hear that, suddenly I felt anger rising up in me, and I can understand this part of the psalm, because I'm like, God, this needs to stop. This is awful. This is horrible. I had that same reaction. Kim, when she graduated from she got a master's in social work. Her first job was with Salvation Army, and she was coordinator of their domestic violence outreach to women. And so as she was first in that position, sometimes I think because of all that she was doing, she would come home and talk to me, maintaining confidentiality of the women, but tell me about the situations. I hear these stories. And literally for 45 minutes after hearing that, I would pace in our little one-room home apartment because just the anger, because we know these things shouldn't happen. This shouldn't happen. We know God is good, and what he's created was good, but sin has destroyed that. And so as we look at this part, we need to realize that At times we do call for God's justice and we want him to end what is violent and wicked. And what's particularly interesting, though, about this is that David is worried about that, but he's also very worried about the people who misuse God's name, who lie about God, who say awful, wicked things about God. And so he has that. Now, as we turn to the New Testament, we know there's a fuller message there that we have to turn to those who are against God in love, and we turn toward them to help them to see God's mercy and love, and they are fully able to be with God forever through the mercy of God through Christ. But again, I think it's good that we don't skip over this part. But almost as if David realizes that his mind has changed from this worshipful time to this time of anger and asking for retribution, he turns back and ends with a prayer. And he says, "Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." So the contrast there in that last part is offensive way is contrasted with the way everlasting. And so he realizes that he is also a fallen person and he needs God's mercy. And so he says, "Test me and know my anxious thoughts and see if there's an offensive way in me. Am I offending you? Am I doing what is wrong? And if I am, change me and lead me in the way everlasting." And so, again, he affirms that it's God's presence that he needs in his life. Well, one question comes up is, is this possible? Can we really feel God's presence? Do we know God's presence? And I remember a book that I read many years ago. It's called The Practice of the Presence of God. Some of you may have read that. It's attributed to Brother Lawrence, a monk. He actually was a lay member of an order of monks. He himself did not write the book. It's actually a compilation of interviews with a Catholic priest who came to interview him, and then some of the letters that he wrote to people who sought his advice. You can see the years he lived there. His life is very interesting. He was born into a very poor family in France, so poor that he had very little options in life, and so he joined the military. Unfortunately for him, that was during the time of the 30 Years' War, which is one of the most destructive wars in Central Europe. He fought in that war, and he received two injuries. One left him lame and in chronic pain. After leaving then the military, he thought, what could he do? And so he went into service as a footman for a man of high standing, but he did very poorly at that job. He described himself as a great awkward fellow who broke everything. And so, not knowing what to do, he was a believer. He decided the best thing to do would be to go to a monastery where he would be a lay member. And the reason he thought that would be good is he thought he would suffer there. He thought it would be bad. In fact, he said that he thought because he was so awkward and not very helpful, that he would be punished constantly. And so he would somewhat be punished and help him follow God. But he says he was surprised what he found there. He actually found peace in the presence of God as he sought him. And so he became determined to live in the constant presence of God, not thinking that any moment he was out of the presence of God. His life changed so much that, which is why he got the attention of people. And people started, as they saw his life and his calm, peaceful presence and his love for God, people began to seek his opinion, seek his counsel, which is very interesting for a man who had no education whatsoever, that he was being sought out for that. But it was interesting in that as I read this book and I reread it to prepare for this, I thought about what were the lessons that he learned. And if you've read it, it's rather repetitive, these interviews and his letters. And I kind of, in my own view, this is my statement, just some four things that he discovered that I thought would be helpful for us. One is he said that God was always present with him, but that's not something he said he would conjure up in his mind. He said that's reality. Reality was God was always present. He said, second was that relationship with God was more valuable than anything else in life. No matter what could be done, that was the most valuable. So therefore, he had the most valuable thing in the world. Third, he would act on these facts by always conversing with God. He said that one of his least favorite things to do was to work in the kitchen. And if I remember right, he spent about 20 years working in the kitchen at the monastery. But he says what changed it was the fact that it didn't matter that he didn't like working in the kitchen, that he was with God, and then working in the kitchen was fine because God was there. But this was, I think, is also very important. Faith in God to forgive sins, faults, and enable him to live in God's presence. He realized that trying to live constantly in the presence of God, he would fail that. He wouldn't be able to do it. And so he decided, though, when he found himself thinking about less worthy things, he would simply ask God's forgiveness and be assured that God would forgive him. He also would stop worrying about his own failings and faults. He would try to follow God and just constantly live in the presence and the knowledge of God's mercy and grace to him. But what do other people think? Well, I found some other things that I thought were helpful. C.S. Lewis, many of you are familiar with him, great Christian thinker. He wrote this: we can ignore, but we can nowhere evade the presence of God. The world is crowded with him. He walks everywhere incognito. And the incognito is not always hard to penetrate. The real labor is to remember to attend. In fact, to come awake. Still more, to stay awake. I read his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And one of the things that he moved him from atheism to belief in God, there was many things. But one of them was this feeling that he would have at different times of something absolutely perfect and joyful that was outside himself. And so I think he may be alluding to this, that God is there. It's simply our job then to remember to attend to that, to pay attention to that, to come awake. Acts 17:26 confirms this. This is Paul talking. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times and history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far away from any one of us. For in him we live and move and we have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. And so Paul confirms that it's not that God is distant from us, it's that we need to become awake, as C.S. Lewis said. I also like this quote, Diogenes Allen: the task of paying attention is demanding. So it's going to be demanding to pay attention to God's presence. But I think he identifies what the real issue is here. It can be performed only as one gains some freedom from self-importance and self-concern. You know, I know this myself. It's just how much I think about myself and what I'm doing, what problem I have that day. And it's, I think, the focus on self that robs us of the knowledge and the sense of God's presence. So there's some tools that I think can help us in this. This was a man named Tom Schwanda who, as I was reading and preparing, had some questions that I think are very helpful for us. And one of the things that, just as I was reading some scholars talk about this, is if we're going to enjoy God's presence, we have to not see it so much as an accomplishment or something to, just a knowledge or something to attain. We're going to work through it, is to let God show himself to us, that if we're willing to pay attention, if we're willing to try, God is there and is quite wanting us to understand and to sense his presence. And so he came up with the questions. He says some things to help you. You can ask yourself, where have I met Jesus today? Just as at the end of the day, ask yourself the question, okay, where did I meet Jesus today? Where was I at when I realized God's presence was there? The second question, where have I missed Jesus today? Did I miss an opportunity to understand God's presence, that he was there with me and wanting me to interact with him? He also wrote kind of maybe companion questions to that, is, well, if I'm going to know where Jesus met me today, what helps me to pay attention to God? Is there certain things that can help me along the way to remind me of that? Or what hinders me from paying attention to God? Maybe we can put those into action, because Tom Schwanda would agree with C.S. Lewis, agree with Brother Lawrence, agrees with Paul that God is there. It's more our job to allow him to be part of our lives. One last thing here that as we end up, there's a song I really like. A Christian writer, singer, Michael Card. And he has a song which is basically Psalm 139. Almost all the words are just simply taken from Psalm 139. The title of it is Search Me and Know Me. But you might just put that on your phone for a couple days and listen to that. It would just remind you of God's presence. Let's pray. Lord, your word confirms that reality is that you're here. You're here with us in this service. But you'll be here with us when we leave the service. You'll be here. You'll be with us when we go to work or at home through the week and doing our busy tasks. And you'll be with the kids at school. You will not leave us or forsake us. Please give us the ability to hear your voice and to turn to you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.